hear the excitement. I hear everybody talking and having a good time, and that's great. I usually hear that on Sunday morning in Bible classes right before the bell rings, and we start talking, and then the dead silence started. Eric had a little bit of the silence problem. So I've got some questions in here tonight, try to keep everything rolling, and I want you to actually participate because this is your classes. I want to actually start by saying how much I appreciate and am edified by the fact of your presence. To think of the fact that there's over 100 people between ninth grade and college in this general area that choose this is more important for your time tonight, to be here now doing what we're doing. Wayne was talking about numbers. It's not numbers for numbers' sake. It's numbers that there's this many people who deem this important enough, deem your soul and your spiritual health important enough to be here. And some of you have traveled from a long ways to do so. And that is much appreciated and means a lot to me. We spent an hour now talking about fighting the good fight. It started with, what was it that Eric said over and over and over? It started with pure love for what? A good conscience, faith, love from a pure heart, right? Well, is there any shock to the fact that theme is going to continue through the rest of the book? Our topic tonight is that of prayer and modesty. And my first thing was, it'd be pretty easy to do a full class on prayer and a full class on modesty, so y'all have nowhere to go between now and 10 o'clock. Just kidding. Obviously, I'm not the one that runs the races. I leave that to Eric, you can tell. I've not trained in a long time to run a race. But we do want to take some time and start looking now into chapter 2 of the book of Timothy. Our study tonight is going to focus on attitude, okay? Whether it be for prayer, not really the how to pray. We're going to talk about who we're instructed to pray for. But it's our attitude that we're going to spend some time focusing on. And our topic is topical versus textual. This isn't going to be a verse-by-verse breakdown of 1 Timothy chapter 2. 1 Timothy chapter 2 in context is instruction toward the assembly, what God, through Paul, wanted the men to do and what he wanted the women to do. But we're going to expand that context. In verse 8, he talks about, I want men everywhere to lift up holy hands. But it is the responsibility of both men and women to pray. And we're going to look at the attitudes and the things that are behind modesty. That's not, and if you can leave with anything else, leave with this. Modesty is not just a lesson for the ladies. Modesty is an attitude. It's a problem with the heart. And it is for both the men and the ladies. So if there are some things, this is our goals for the study tonight. But let's start with a question. When we're in prayer, just off the top of your head, who is it we typically pray for? Who are the first ones that come to mind that you're praying for? You got sick? Ourselves? Excellent. Who else? Those that are traveling. And is that of the world or is that of our family or maybe even our spiritual family, our church family? Right? Now. Excellent. And that is an excellent lead-in to this next one. 2 Timothy, or 1 Timothy chapter 2 opens up with a statement. Therefore, reaching back into chapter 1, because these things have happened, because to fight this good fight, therefore I exhort you, or I urge you, first of all, but that supplication and prayer and intercession and giving of thanks be made for all men. Not just my physical family, not just the family that I have where I attend and where I worship and where I go to church, but that prayer and supplication and intercession, anybody know what that word intercession means? Sounds like a lot of different words for the same thing, right? What if I'm interceding, what am I doing? I'm praying to, what'd you start to say? A medium. I'm praying to God for someone else, on someone else's behalf. I'm giving thanks to God for someone else. Verse 1, giving thanks, be made for all men. And verse 2 has a tendency to be a little bit more of a taking back. Who are we to pray for in verse 2? Those in authority. I'm to pray for my president. I'm to pray for my dictator ruler. I'm to pray for my governor, maybe my boss. I'm to pray for those that are in authority over me. Now, is that one a little bit harder than praying for my physical brother or my spiritual brother that's on a long journey, that's sick, that has some need, that might need me to intercede for them? But notice what Paul said. Paul actually even told us why that we were to pray for those in authority. What is the why behind why we're to pray for those in authority? That they can lead us in such a way that we can live how? And I'll go ahead and give everybody a nice hint. Most of my questions or the answers are behind me. That's right, that we can go and live a quiet and peaceful life. Our prayers are for those in authority over us that we may be able to live a quiet and peaceful life. My prayer is that when my children are my age, that they can still live in this country. I pray for the leaders of this country so that when they're my age, that they can still come here and worship peacefully, quietly, that it's not illegal, it's not against the law, and that they may be able to lead godly and reverent lives without those external influences. They may still have to live godly and reverent lives even if the leadership doesn't allow it. But this prayer that we're to offer, the prayer for those in authority, are so that the Christians may live this quiet and peaceful life, that they may rule in such a way that being a Christian, that being godly, is not persecuted. So, we're to pray for all men, and we're also to pray for those, one section of those, with those in leadership or in authority. And as we continue through these verses, we begin to be told the why to pray. Verse 3, really hard. Why should we pray? You know, what is the why we pray for all men? It's pleasing to God. God said so. Okay? And then there is a second reason in verse 4. What is God's desire? That all should be saved. We're to pray for all men. We're to pray for those, not just those that treat us well, but we're to pray for all men because God desires their salvation. We're going to spend some more time talking about that. For this is, verse 4, for this is good and acceptable in the sight of our Lord, God our Lord, who desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. That's why we pray, and that's why we're praying for all men. If that's not my prayer for anyone, who has a problem? The person that needs prayer, me. Okay? This is where it comes back to our heart. It comes back to our attitude. I've got to be able to pray for all men. Those that I consider my friends, those that I may consider my enemies. I've got to be able to pray because God's desire is that all be saved and all come to the knowledge of truth. And I ask you to ask yourself that question. Is there that somebody that you can pray for? That you can't make yourself pray for? And if you do have that situation, that's not that person's fault. That's something that we need to look internally for. So we start the study out with that of prayer. And if I keep clicking this, it will finally catch up with me. All right. He desires all men to be saved. I can go to James. Does God have any partiality to the rich that comes in fine clothing? Or to the one that comes in with a lot less? No, God shows no partiality. In Galatians, the third chapter, verse 28, there is neither Jew nor Greek. Talked a little bit about that in chapter 1. There's neither slave nor free. There's neither male nor female. You are all one in Christ. In Colossians chapter 3 and verse 11, where there is neither Greek nor Jew, circumcised nor uncircumcised, barbarian or Scythian, slave or free, but Christ is all in all. Okay? This concept continues. God desires us to pray for all men. He shows no partiality, and we should not either. But our prayer for them should be that they come to the knowledge of the truth. Or, if they're our leadership, that they rule our country in such a way that we can live godly, that we can live peaceable lives before them. Now in verse 8. Verse 8 is kind of the transition between our two topics tonight. In verse 8, he says, "I desire therefore that men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting." Okay, and everywhere, in every church, in every place, God's desire is that we have men offering up prayers to God. Now, do we see any holdover from the first chapter without doubting? What do you mean without doubting? What is that? What is the element that lets you pray without doubting? Faith. That same faith you had to have in the first chapter. It is faith that allows us to pray without doubting. And what's the first one? I've made the point, is there anyone that we can't pray for? Is there anyone that I've put myself in this situation with that I find it hard to pray for? What is the other point that he makes? Without what? Wrath. He loves all men. We should love all men. We should want all men to be saved. Our prayer should be without wrath. And our prayer should be without doubt. Because we believe that he has power to do those things. Now, I've kind of come down and I'm going to go back up. One of the phrases that he said in this verse, lifting up holy hands. Somebody tell me what lifting up holy hands means. Okay, praying. What's the concept of holy? Set apart? Righteous? Okay, so lifting up of those holy hands. What about the prayers of the wicked? Does this go back to chapter 1? What about us? We got to have that good conscience. We got to have our heart right, our relationship right with God to keep our prayers from being hindered. If we look at Proverbs the 15th chapter, verse 29, the Lord is not far from the wicked, but he hears the prayers of the righteous. I'm sorry. There's a knot that I put in there that's really important. And I didn't even hear anybody snicker. The Lord is far from the wicked, but he hears the prayers of the righteous. When I put a knot where it isn't supposed to go, you can stop me next time. One who turns away his ear from hearing the law, even his prayers is an abomination. What about that one that's turned his back on God, that has not kept his word? In John chapter 9 and verse 31, "Now we know that God does not hear sinners. But if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, he hears him." Does my relationship with God have anything to do with whether he hears my prayers? The answer to that is yes. That's lifting up holy hands. On the other side, the prayers of the righteous are heard. In 1 John chapter 3, almost really the entire book is on the topic. But, and whatever we ask, we receive from him. Whatever we ask, we receive from him. Why? Because we keep his commandments and do those things which are pleasing in his sight. In James chapter 5 and verse 16, God hears the prayers of what? The fervent fervor. Bleh. Sorry. That's to see if you're awake too. God hears the effective fervent prayers of who? The righteous man. Thank you. The effective fervent prayers of the righteous man will avail much. Right here behind, confess your trespasses one to another. And after you confess your trespasses one to another, what are you to do then? Pray for one another. I come and tell John something, or I come and can tell this room something that's been between me and God. What's the response? Prayer. He's praying for me. Come and confess your sins, your trespasses one to another, and pray for one another, that you may be healed. That prayer for all men, those that are of our spiritual faith, those of our physical families, but then of all men. And then we go from verse 8 to verse 9 and 10. And sometimes I kind of struggled with, you know, why did I have these two topics together, prayer and modesty? And kind of like Eric said, because Paul did, okay? In chapter 2, that's the exact transition that Paul makes. I wish that men everywhere, speaking of the prayers that's being offered up in the church in verse 8, that men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands. In verse 9, he makes that transition. In like manner also, that women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair, or gold, or pearl, or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. And we're going to stop there, and I actually, since Cheryl is my wife and she's teaching the class in the morning, I know some of her material as well. So I'm going to kind of slow down there because she's going to finish some of this chapter out. But he makes a transition from prayer to modesty. In like manner, this concept of modest apparel, with shamefastness, the sobriety, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly array, but that which is a woman professing godliness with good works. When you hear the word modesty, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? Below the knee? Okay, excellent. Throw some more things out. When you hear the word modesty, what's the first thing that comes to mind? Clothing. That's true. What else? Here it's an adjective talking about our clothing. What else comes to mind? Is it too low? Is it too short? Is it too high? But what is this passage talking about? Is that how little clothing these ladies had on? What's the point being made here? Not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly array. What were they doing? What's the point? They were overdressed. They were, look at me. Probably, look, I have more money than you do. Look, I have better clothing. I have these better earrings. I have this. Or it had become a contest of who could wear the best clothing, who could wear the best. Now, this is not modesty in the sense of how little someone is wearing. This is how much they're wearing. When we start talking about the concept of modesty, by definition, the word modesty is being well-kept, orderly, quiet, and humble in speech, in behavior, or dress. Your speech can be immodest. Your behavior can be immodest. Your dress can be immodest. Okay? And it can be immodest by being too much or too little. It could be too tight, or it could be too revealing. But I want us to think about tonight, the key to the whole thing is, it is so much more about your attitude than the clothing. Okay? And hopefully that point will be made clear as we continue our night. But I want you to remember this definition. Definition of modesty is being well-kept, orderly, quiet, humble in speech, behavior, and dress. I've got one in a minute that I like to share that I think is, I call it the nutshell definition, and it's drawing attention to God, not drawing attention to myself. That's the easy one to remember. Modesty is not drawing attention to me. Do you see how that fits in with the costly clothing? When somebody comes in with the long garbed robes, who are they drawing attention to? Themselves. Does it work? Yes, it worked then, and it still works today. When someone comes in overtly overdressed, it still works. What's the problem? They're drawing the attention to themselves. Remember, the first word there, modesty, modest, quiet and humble in speech and behavior or dress, does not draw attention to oneself. Okay? Now, one of the other things that I find very interesting here, this Greek word, kosmos, and I'm not a Greek scholar, all I can do is look it up and retell it to you. So, that's as far as it goes. But, I find it very interesting that I do have Bible software that I can search. That same Greek word is the same Greek word that's translated good behavior in the qualifications for an elder. This concept, though this word modesty is translated the word modesty when we're talking about the description of the apparel of the women in the church there that Paul's talking to Timothy about. The concept here, I do believe, and I think I'm safe in saying, is so much more about that of having a good behavior toward God. Having that concept of, I'm going to not draw attention to myself, but I'm going to profess godliness to God. Shamefacedness. I've seen articles written that we don't know shame anymore. And I think to some extent that's true. I think we live in a culture that has put so much in our face that what was considered shameful in the 30s was considered okay in the 50s. What was considered shameful in the 50s had become okay by the 70s. And boy, by the time we're where we are now, what was considered shameful in the 40s is nothing now. Okay? That's being overdressed now. So, this concept of shamefacedness, what does it mean to be ashamed? That conscience that he was talking about in the first chapter, I've done something and it bothers me. I should, you know, I go out and I'm dressed in such a way that I go out and I'm drawing attention to myself. There's something that's bothering me. That's shamefacedness, okay? In Genesis, the third chapter, we know the story well. After Adam and Eve had sinned, they realized they were, fill in the blank. They had sinned, they had taken the fruit, they realized they were naked. What did they do? That's right. They sewed together fig leaves to themselves and made a covering. Depending on your translation, some may say a girdle, some may say a covering. A fairly small thing. So they're now clothed, right? God comes to the garden to walk through the garden as he had done before. What do? They hide. Why? When he asked them, why are you hiding? Their answer was what? Because we were naked. First, he said, why? You know, why? How do you know that? And he went into what the sin that they had committed. But at the end of that, did he say, no, he was not naked? No, he made for them tunics. They made for themselves coverings, and he made for them tunics. What is what I'm trying to get at? That shame. They knew shame then. And I'm not saying we don't know shame today. I full well believe we know shame. Do I think our sense of shame has been hammered on? Yes. I think our society hammers at our shame, but yet we still know it. The next word is sobriety. And I think there's a lot of modesty issues that happen because we've lost shamefacedness. And sometimes I think there's a lot of modesty issues that happen because of sobriety. What does the word sober mean? You're not what? You're not drunk. If you're drunk, do you make good decisions? No, if you're drunk, you don't think clearly. If you're drunk, you don't make good decisions. So if you're sober, you're of sound mind. You're making good decisions. You're thinking ahead of the decisions that you have to make. A lot of times when it comes to immodest apparel or immodest behavior, it is that concept of not thinking, not being sober-minded. Thinking that what I'm doing, what I'm saying, what I'm wearing is making a statement. I am either professing, we're going to get there in just a minute, I'm either professing godliness, or I'm professing myself. I'm putting myself up to be viewed, to be looked at. Likewise, the same word here that's translated sobriety is also used in the qualifications as that of a sound mind or being sober-minded in that of the elders. So this concept in this mental attitude is definitely more than just a thing for the ladies. Be thinking about. We all should have this modest apparel, this modest behavior, this modest speech. Do not let your dormant, in 1 Peter chapter 3, the first four verses, speaks directly to the wives and the role of submission. Picking up toward the end of that reading, you can't really see the color change, picking up right there. Do not let your adorning be merely outwardly. The arranging of the hair, the wearing gold, or putting on a fine apparel, but let it rather be the hidden person of the heart, with an incorruptible beauty of gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. Does this look a lot like the verse we just looked at in 1 Peter or 1 Timothy? Yeah. They're very close. Here we start talking about the putting on the gold rings. Here it's the wearing of gold, putting on a fine apparel. But let it rather be the hidden person of the heart. Here we're talking about the inward beauty. The hidden person. Incorruptible beauty. That's beauty that can't be taken away. That inward beauty, your behavior, your modest behavior. Some of the guys in this room was blessed with a lot more physical beauty than I am. That can be taken away. It was for me. No, I don't know that I ever had it. But inward beauty, can that ever be taken away? The attitude, my modest behavior, and the way I present myself, same for guys, same for girls, that inward beauty cannot be taken away. That beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. The world will tell us that a gentle and quiet spirit is not precious. Humble, meek, those are the ones to be destroyed, to be stepped on, to be pushed out of the way to get where I want to go. God tells us that that is an attitude that we should have. That's the things that are very precious in the sight of God. And that's part of faith, is to take those things that are precious in the sight of God and put them before those things that are precious in the sight of the world. But very much like what was said in 1 Timothy chapter 2, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. So when we go back and ask ourselves that question, do we draw attention to ourselves? Am I drawing attention to me, or am I drawing attention to God with my speech, with my behavior, with my dress? Let me ask you a question. And first, let me ask this question. Is there anybody in here that does not believe that you say something to other people? You communicate to other people by the way maybe you walk or the way you dress. Is there anybody believe that that's not true? No. Now, you always communicate to someone else. You make a first impression. What are you doing? You're communicating to that person. For example, if I put this picture up on the screen, what's the first thing you think? Doctor, nurse. I'm not going to go into x-ray tech, that goes around the neck. We're probably talking doctor or nurse here. Okay? That's the first place we go. Why? She says something. Okay? If I put this next picture up on the screen, the graphic is pretty unclear. But the whole picture here is that of a gang situation, two gangs about ready to fight. Does their appearance say anything about them? What's the first thing you think when you see two gangs about ready to fight? You see it on television. There's this group and this group, and they're about ready to take each other apart. What's the first thing you think? Well, let's get out of here. That's a good first thing to think. Let's watch this on television and not in person. That's a good thing to think. But do you not immediately think something about the character of the people that are involved in this situation? Once again, hard to see this graphic on the screen. But immediately, with what we say, and what we do, and how we dress, we make statements. And here we have a very professional gentleman that I think businessman, first time I see that picture. Professional, maybe lawyer. Glasses in the mouth, reading over the book as he goes into whatever event that he's there for. But when we see these pictures, something comes to mind. When you present yourself every day, you're going to say something. You're going to profess godliness, or you're going to profess something else. Maybe it's yourself. You're going to profess godliness, or you're going to profess yourself. And you can choose, or you can profess worldliness. You can choose what that is. But that's why I go back over and over to this distinction. The way I'm dressing, the way I'm behaving, the way I'm speaking, do I draw attention to myself, or am I drawing attention to God? Going back to how do we tie these together? Who are we to pray for? All men. Who are we, this concept of we're to be modest, we're to present ourselves before all men. And the one that I find kind of interesting here is, which in 2 Timothy, or in 1 Timothy and in 1 Peter 3, is overdressed or underdressed the one that was addressed? And can I get one more way to say the word dressed in there? Being overdressed is what's being addressed in that situation, in both of those passages. Why is being someone from behind this row taught to me, or from over here is fine too. Why is being overdressed? What is wrong with that? How does that get into immodesty? That's right. I'm taking that attention and I'm drawing it to myself. In this case, because I have more money than you in the two passages here, the fine clothing. I have more money than you, therefore I can wear better clothing than you. A very key point to this, and I think it makes the illustration very well, I was in Australia a few years ago. And I talked to Bill Hall. He had given me a name of an individual that I could meet up when I got to Melbourne, and that he would help me find a church to worship with. So I get to town, and I call Mr. Hall up, and I asked him. He said, yeah, Melbourne can be kind of hard to get around in. Can I just come pick you up? I said, that's great. Even better. I don't even have to try to figure out public transit because I got here the day before and hadn't slept yet. So, first time I'd been there, I was going to a new group of people. I went ahead. I was there on business, so I'd taken suit. So I just put a suit on. And I should have thought about this being a beach town, I guess. I don't know. But I got to the car, and the guy pulls back, and he says, you're going to feel a little out of place today. And I got to worship service, and the ones that were taking part in service that day were the ones that was wearing their khakis and polos. Did I feel a little overdressed for the situation? Now, if I would have continued to wear that over and over and over after having known that, would that not have been this problem? Yeah. I would have been being immodest. I would have been saying something to them, drawing attention to myself. Now, I pretty quickly decided that, okay, anytime you let me get a coat off, the coat was gone. And after that morning service, the tie was gone. And they didn't see anything else like that for the rest of the 3 weeks that I was there, I can assure you. But that didn't take but one lesson. But the fact of the matter is, when we are setting out to do anything, whether it's to wear the fine clothes or to wear less clothing, to draw attention to ourselves versus professing godliness, we have crossed that line into immodesty. Yes, sir. Absolutely. That's point well said, and let me go ahead and say it to everybody with the microphone in place. You can go in and you can actually take the clothing off so that you look like, not take the clothing off, y'all know what I mean. You can back the clothing down to where you're not wearing the costly jewelry. See, I was seeing if you're still awake. You can take the costly jewelry off and you can look just like everything else. But if I walk in with a haughty attitude and if I walk in with my speech, with my behavior, excellent point that Michael made, that is still just as much as modesty. Is if I walked in with too much or too little clothing on to draw that attention back to myself. Excellent point. Both of those. Don't put these things on to draw attention to yourself, but profess godliness. Now, being overdressed is immodest, but likewise, being underdressed is immodest. Most times, we do have more trouble with being underdressed in the world. Has anybody been to Walmart lately? Starting about April, at least here, you know, some of you are from Indiana. I've seen some of the states. Some of you from Indiana. Here in North Alabama, when it starts getting really, really hot, say about February, no, I'm not quite that soon, but it is pretty close. Go to Walmart and this horrible transformation happens. People are no longer shameful. They weren't shameful in the winter either. They were just cold. But you see this transition happen in Walmarts all over the world, I'm sure. As soon as things start warming up, shame goes out the door. And shame was gone before. But it begins to show. Being underdressed is also immodest. Is there anyone in this room that disagrees with the fact that God made man and woman so that they would be attracted to each other? That is true from the Bible. And there's everything in nature that points that out to be true as well. So why is it, do we try to find ways to take this principle that we know and everybody, no one will disregard that everybody knows is true, and we try to discount it? Okay? We try to discount it by saying, oh, that's just a certain group of religious people that thinks that you shouldn't wear this, fill in the blank. You notice I'm very carefully staying away from lines, drawing lines on the body. This is about attitude. God made men and women so that they're attracted to each other. That brings with it a very important responsibility that we all need to be careful. And I want to also ask another question for you to think about. Not many people in here, I don't think I see that much vanity in the room, not that I can look into people's heart and see vanity. Not many people go to look at themselves in the mirror and say, boy, I look good. We don't do that. Most people do not just go and look at themselves and think about how good they look. Therefore, you think, surely I couldn't. It doesn't matter how I dress because I couldn't draw that kind of attention from someone. Look at me. And I'm not talking about having a horrible self-worth either. But I'm saying we don't look at ourselves in that way. Most people don't look at themselves in such a way to say that if I go out wearing this, everybody's going to be looking at me. We've got to remember we have a responsibility. And it isn't you looking at yourself that I'm worried about. It's not you looking at yourself that God's worried about. It is, what are you professing? Are you professing godliness? Or are you professing self? Are you drawing attention to yourself? This is also just as true from worldly standards and just as accepted from worldly standards. Everybody fights and everybody thinks that the concept of being modest is silly. But when I was to put this list up, and I've actually got some quotes in a few minutes to back my statements up here so that you don't think it's just me talking. But dresses or shirts that are unbuttoned or low cut in the front, skirts that are short or have really high splits, strapless, open back dresses, what I call with guys running shorts that are, floppy undergarments, for lack of a better word. What are these? What are the purpose for these things? Do they make you run faster? No, they don't make you run faster. What are the purpose for these things? Okay. Now, it may not be by the person who dons them and puts them on. That may not have been their purpose. But the purpose by the people who design these things are very simple. And it's not to draw attention to God. It's to draw attention to yourself. To draw attention and say, look at me. Whether it is, and going back to a point that Michael made just a minute ago, might very well be immodest by being a shirt with some suggestive slogan on it. Should I, as a Christian, wear a t-shirt that says Budweiser? No. Should I go out and drink a Budweiser? Then I should not go out and profess that. Is that professing godliness? Should I wear something that's advertising for a restaurant or a club or something to where promiscuity is just everywhere? To see somebody come in a t-shirt that there's nothing really wrong on the t-shirt, but it's advertising a strip club? We've got to think. That's why I go back to sober-minded or being sobriety. Thinking, you are saying something. We all agreed you say something with what you wear. And modesty goes a long way. And this is just a kind of a by point. Sometimes we think baggy is good. And this is just a free extra point. Can't tell you how many times I've been lecturing for work at a conference somewhere. Or it's even occasionally in a Bible class. And there is a lady or a young lady that's sitting on a front row that the skirt is baggy. And someone who would never show that much of themselves didn't realize just how much they were showing. And I have been in situations, don't look at the third chair on the front row. Just don't let your eyes go that way. The entire time I'm talking at a business conference or other places, the entire time I'm talking, I'm over here. Why? I can't look there. That's sobriety. That doesn't go into someone who is overtly saying, look at me. That's going into, I think you've probably all seen the articles, look at yourself in a mirror, sit. That goes for guys too. Baggy shorts, guys, same way. You can show a whole lot more than you ever meant to show really quickly with baggy shorts. That goes into sobriety. So that was my extra freebie that I just kind of throw in. But I throw in guys without shirts. I throw in muscle shirts. I throw in these things. We talk about locker room talk. Why is that? That's when the guys and girls are usually separated. And if you want to think that these things don't cause people to look and think these ways about you, go listen to the locker rooms. Listen to the guys getting ready in PE and talking about how many public, private schools. You know, you hear it happen. That, did you see what so-and-so is wearing today? And I promise you guys, that goes on, not personally, I don't know it personally, but I have been told. That goes on in the ladies' locker rooms as well. Did you see so-and-so today and what he was wearing? What is it? He's wearing some outfit that shows the physique off. That is drawing attention to oneself and not drawing attention to God. Whether it's guy, whether it's girl. The key is what I'm putting on and what I'm about to wear, who is it drawing attention to? Being underdressed is immodest. This was one that come, notice this, 1955. Older person, even to me. Dr. Benjamin Spott. The women on the beach, who the men can't help watching, are the ones who figures men want to watch and are bold enough to show them in this matter. That's not changed since 1955. I have a hard time reading that quote just the way it's worded. This one is the mother of the miniskirt, some London fashion. So this isn't me saying it. This is the lady who actually went out and developed and promoted and marketed the miniskirt. Mary Quant. Mini clothes, as it was called, are symbolic of those girls who want to seduce a man. November 13, 1967. When asked which where these kind of clothing was heading, she replied simply with one word, sex. These things are truth. We've got to accept these things as truth. This isn't a preacher that knows Scripture saying this. This is the ones in the world side. They know it. The ones who designed it, they know it. And it's intentional. 1971 edition of the Atlantic Constitutional. This question was put to a group of Atlanta teenagers. So got a group of teenagers like this together, but probably was not a group of Christian teenagers that they got together. And the question was put in front of them that said, when you put on, you don the swimsuit, put on the swimsuit. I don't use the word don every day. When you put on the swimsuit or you don the swimsuit and go out, is it the exercise or the sun that you're looking for on the beach? The young ladies quickly responded, it's the boys. Attention to self or attention to God, professing godliness. Last quote I've got, David Tant, 1979. In a discussion with a group of young people, the question was asked, why girls and boys go around with shirts or blouses unbuttoned to daring extents, to wear otherwise suggestive clothing? The consensus was, quickly, by the one writing this, no, by the people in the room, to advertise. So when I say this, we went back and we said, the principle is that God made men and women so that they were attracted to each other. The world has used that in such a way so that these things have been done. They've been designed. And have they been sold? Yes, they've been sold. And just go to Walmart to find out. And the question still remains, does it draw attention to me or am I professing godliness? That's the question we have to ask ourselves with each of these. Now, the last three points that we've got here, and I'm doing pretty good here on time, I do believe. Are there legitimate lines? You notice that I've not talked about lines tonight, something being too short, something being too low, too open in the back. Because if we address that issue right there, is it drawing attention to ourselves or am I professing godliness? I'm a true, firm believer that that first question of lines will go away. If I am professing godliness, this line will go away. But we can't ask the question, are there legitimate lines? We have very little, truly, very little scriptural information here. First, we talked about it earlier, in Genesis chapter 3, they come to the realization after eating the tree of knowledge of good and evil. They had the guilt, and they realized they were naked, and they made for themselves coverings, tunics, girdles, or into words that we would know, underwear. Okay, those undergarments. At the time that that was what they was wearing, they still called themselves, when questioned by God, they were still ashamed and they still called themselves naked. That's a hint we have. And I'm pretty confident, from all the reading I've done, that it covers a lot more than modern-day bikini does. But yet, still considered naked. In their own words, not mine. Likewise, in Exodus, when the priests had to go up the steps to offer the sacrifices, I'm not sure why, they wore long robes instead of pants. It was the custom. But in their robes that they wore over it, we talked about baggy shorts a little bit earlier, or baggy clothing, Well, guess what? As they would go up on that ladder, they would be exposing themselves. And in Exodus chapter 28, verse 42, they would make trousers, linen trousers. Once again, its purpose was to cover them. And the only thing we have there is, it shall reach from the waist to the thigh. And really, we don't have anything where God has said any more or less that I know of. I'll be glad to be corrected on the matter. About that of lines. So that's why I go back. We have tons more that God has said of that of attitude. That if our attention is to not draw attention to self, but draw attention to God, I think the lines will take care of themselves. Going to a point, in the last 2 points, we're going to the points that Michael suggested earlier. We haven't talked a lot about them. We don't have a lot of time to talk about them. But bodily movements can be just as immodest as too much clothes or too little clothes. Okay? You take and just on the television itself and take and look at some of the dance routines that you see in commercials that go by. Okay? We'll stick with something as simple as the commercials that go by that you can't do anything about. When the usually ladies in those commercials are dancing or jumping or acting in such a way to draw attention to whatever it is they're advertising or selling, do you agree that bodily movements can be immodest? Are those bodily movements, back to our first definition, are they quiet? Are they humble? Are they gentle? No. Are bodily movements, gestures, dances, these are things that can be just as immodest as wearing too much clothes to draw attention to yourself or too little clothes to draw attention to yourself. If you look at a dance floor and you see people out dancing, you will see the movements that catch everybody's attention and people start watching. That's immodest. There's no other way around it. Is it drawing attention to self? Is it drawing attention to God, professing godliness? Whether it is dancing, sitting, moving, gestures, how many music videos have we seen that ends with different sexual gestures? Okay, not going into graphic details. Have no desire to go into graphic details. But music videos is the number one example of what I'm talking about with body movements and gestures. And you don't have to flip by long. And usually it's music videos that you see snapshots of as commercials. We could go and we could look at the same kind of quotes. Their purpose is to excite people. In those cases, to sell something. A car, beer, something they're trying to sell. But they use this known truth of the fact that these movements that they do excite. We should always keep in mind Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 4. Neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather the giving of thanks. Kind of coming to our last point. Nor foolish talking, nor coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but the rather of giving of thanks. Coming back to this concept of prayer from the beginning, that's what we're to spend our time doing. Praying for ourselves, praying for others, praying that they may come to know the truth. In a person who is supposed to be a Christian, is there any place for one supposed to be professing godliness for a dirty joke to come out of their mouth? What is a dirty joke professing? Worldliness. Or much worse. There is no place for someone who is professing godliness to use their mouths in such a way to profess worldliness, to say it and to tell it. And sometimes sobriety is one of the biggest things, the biggest key that I can talk about here. How many times has somebody let something slip out of their mouth before they caught it? My hands come up. Happened to me last night with my kids. Something came out before I caught it. The bad thing about with your kids is they get repeated back to you when you do it. What happens? What was it? Was it something I intentionally planned ahead to say? No, it was something I was not sober-minded enough. I was not watching every word that was coming out, and it comes out. That's the thing of sobriety. That's the thing of being sober-minded. So many times, we tell the joke first and think about what it meant later. And I've been guilty of it. I think probably we've all been guilty of it. Sobriety says, modesty says, we think about what we're going to say, and those things that we say, those things that we do, the way that we use our body, are professing godliness. Our speech can be immodest. Eric said he was going to be surprised by his PowerPoint. I was too. I decided to go in the wrong order, going up the screen instead of down. But our speech can also draw attention away from God and to ourselves, whether it be dirty jokes, whether it be lewd comments, whatever it may be. So I'll leave you with the question. I thought it came up on the next page. Does it draw attention to yourself? Is that the specific definition of modesty? No. But if you're not drawing attention to yourself and you're professing godliness, you don't have to worry about the lines. Because you're going to say, when I walk into the room, what is the message I want to tell to everyone? I thank you for your time. I thank you for your attention. Is there any announcements? I think we got some announcements here before we go. Is there any questions before we break away to announcements? Sure. Excellent point. I wish I'd have mic'd you for it, because I don't think I can repeat it all. I hope everybody heard it. Excellent point. You're right. It is about holiness. That was over and over in chapter 1. We can't pray without being holy. And modesty is that, just that, is being holy. Anything else? All right. I thank you for your time and your attention. We'll get back off here tomorrow morning.